Welcome to Bonding Time, the BDA's podcast series on markets, business conditions, and regulatory and legislative policy impacting the bond markets. BDA is the only trade group in DC representing sell-side bond dealers, and we're really excited to bring you this new product covering a range of pressing issues and talking to bond market leadership from firms headquartered coast to coast. Today's feature is titled Washington Roundup and is a bi-weekly discussion with lobbyists in Washington, D.C. on legislative and regulatory activity directly related to the U.S. bond markets. Now let me turn to my colleagues, Michael Decker and Brett Bolton, for a roundup discussion with Emily Brock, who's the director of GFOA's Federal Liaison Center here in Washington, D.C.
I must say this is a real star-studded lineup for the first Bonding Time. Welcome all. I hope everybody's doing pretty well today, and I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
Thanks, Brett. Me too.
Good afternoon, Emily and Brett.
Hey, Michael. So, Emily, let's get started with you and your role at the GFOA Federal Liaison. I know our members are pretty familiar with the organization as a whole, and most are probably pretty familiar with you as well. How's your advocacy looking? What have you guys been working on? And I know Michael and Decker and I have been working with you in the Public Finance Network. What do you want to describe that as? Advocacy arm, advocacy coalition, muni coalition extraordinaire. I guess go from there.
Muni power on the Hill.
There we go. Yeah.
Together we are strong. So thank you again for the invitation, Brett and Michael. It's my pleasure to join the Bond Dealers of America. I think we work hand in hand so very well together in our advocacy efforts on the Hill, and appreciate the opportunity that we can to work together and provide outreach to one another. So as you mentioned, you know, a lot of folks probably know about GFOA. I'm always shocked that each time we have a member count, even throughout the pandemic, we continue to grow. We're at 21,000 members plus, and each month we register more members. And, you know, we think we see, in general, what our new membership is telling us is that they see the value in not just our education and ability to commune with one another, but also our ability to provide advocacy when they aren't able to make it to Washington. And so it's always been a great thrill to kind of see that power kind of generate together. We create these best practices, we create this education, but also we create a loud voice on the Hill for issuers and state and local governments generally. Now, as you mentioned, Brett, I'm always delighted each week to host the Public Finance Network. It's a broader association of 43 municipal market associations together. And we talk everything soup to nuts, from CARES Act to direct funding, all the way to as ticky-tack as mathy a concept as advance refunding and BQ debt. And so by 43 issuer organizations, of course, we know our two organizations, the bond dealers and the issuers, but also, you know, there are associations that cover public gas and public water. And those folks are absolutely involved in signer advocacy efforts and help to promote our voice louder and clearer across the 535 members of Congress.
I promise you there's nothing ticky-tack about advance refundings with this crowd. So that's definitely a top-line issue, I know, for our organization as well. I think with some of your statements there, the topic of the week seems like it's been the topic of the past 6 months at this point, is stimulus. What are we on, stimulus 5.5, 6.5? I honestly don't know where we are.
I think folks are calling it CARES 2. Look, all you have to do is just add a number behind something, and you've got the stimulus efforts ahead of us. And I think what's exhausting, I think, for everyone outside the Beltway is that there's nothing happening, that there's a perception that nothing's happening. The House, as we all know, a couple months ago put out the HEROES Act, and that was the $2.2 trillion Democratic caucus initiative that really was just jam-packed. Active, you know, every policy initiative that they were interested in advancing in a second round of stimulus. Everything that they saw that worked about CARES, they put that in there, and then they added on more stuff. You know, the Senate response was, all right, we're not putting icing on this cake. that this is a pound cake at best. It's about a $500 billion effort that really just addresses the core features that, you know, the Republican caucus and the Senate said will help to stimulate our economy. Unfortunately, in the Senate stimulus, it did not include any stimulus for state and local governments. That, of course, is our number one priority, along with the big seven, the counties, the cities, the mayors, the governors. And that's unfortunate because we would very much like to see and have a better understanding with the Republican caucus, which we do with our champions, that state and local governments bear about 75% of our nation's infrastructure. And we need stimulus right now. The CARES Act went really far. We need something else in order to stabilize the market. So here we are. And of course, 2 days ago, President Trump mentioned, you know, I'm going to meet him in the middle. $1.5 trillion is my max. We're still waiting on any information that would help us better understand what's in his ideas, in his plan. And we're ready to support it as long as it does also support state and local government stimulus.
Emily, handicap what you think is the chance that we'll have a substantial stimulus bill enacted into law with significant help for state and local governments before the election?
You always ask me to over-under these choices, Michael, and it makes me uncomfortable, but...
Decker he's a bookie for Muni Provisions.
Yeah, we're all betting people, yeah, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm the glass is half full kind of girl.
Emily's always the optimist, and we bring the negative energy, so please set us straight here.
And in being the optimist, what I look forward to, of course, is November. And I think that there is a lot of people who are vulnerable and who, if they kind of come back without a stimulus and the markets go into a tailspin once again, that really is not a good look for them. So I think that, you know, this, the Senate skinny, for what it's worth, is a messaging bill that says we are willing to work with you. Help us help you. And so I'm at 51% positive.
That's helpful to know. And who are some of our best friends in the Senate who will help move this forward?
So I think that's a great question. You know, obviously we have a fair amount of Democrats, but Democrats are in the minority. You know, Senator Schumer is in a very hard hit COVID state. Senator Menendez has long advocated for muties, even in the CARES Act. But I also think that we need to look on the other side of the aisle, that we have Senator Wicker very interested in helping out municipal bond efforts out of Mississippi. Just today, I heard that Senator Fisher out of Nebraska was willing to jump on that bill as well. So I think it's important to acknowledge that local efforts at local levels, those are the senators that we need to make sure that we target, that these stimulus efforts are part and parcel, a place that we can go. One other Republican that I did want to mention, of course, is Senator out of Louisiana, Cassidy. Senator Cassidy out of Louisiana, co-sponsors with Senator Menendez a $500 billion stimulus bill for state and local government. So again, we are bipartisan, we are bicameral, and we will work with anyone who is willing to work with us.
So I think that 500 that Cassidy Menendez provided in their package was similarly represented on the House Problem Solvers Caucus package that was released this week. Then today I hear that they're not even considering at this point in time providing language beyond the PowerPoint document, which I'm looking at currently, outlining what they would like to have. So is it fair to say that this is just a positioning document? There's no real legislative effort pushing that $1.5 trillion package?
Yeah, I think what happened was Problem Solvers, who are pretty famous actually for coming out with some moderate, middle-of-the-road kind of plans. But as soon as the caucus kind of says, all right, shape up or ship out, they shape up. And so they create something, but as soon as the leadership says, yeah, we're not so cool on that, then, you know, it kind of loses steam. And I think that's where we are with that right now.
I think that's fair. And that makes sense. I mean, I've really torn myself apart, optimist, negative this week with Trump's proclamations of $1.5 trillion. They're going to push it. But then I see every senator just coming out against it within an hour or two. So I'll take your 51%. I think I'm putting mine at maybe 15%. Sorry about that. But I hope you're right. I hope I'm wrong. So on that note, I guess we can turn to another negative point for me, unfortunately, is the House Transportation Reauthorization I'm hearing a one-year extension, which really puts any true new legislative municipal efforts that were included in the House package, at least at a standstill till the lame duck, if not January 2021. Is that your read today?
Yeah, remember the Senate put together a $352 billion package that was essentially, you know, kind of a new take on the Transportation Reauthorization Act. You know, that was before stimulus. And then the House came along and said, cool, they kind of did what they did with HEROES. They looked right at, you know, that 350 some billion and they said, all right, we're going to double that. We're going to triple that, actually. They were at 1.5 trillion, but it was a cornucopia of bond provisions. Am I right?
It really was. It was a thing of beauty, but then it honestly got sidelined as a liberal Christmas tree, basically, which was disappointing to say the least, because there were so many good provisions included in that bill.
So I think it's fair to say, to your point, it's lingering out there, but it probably doesn't have a lot of advancement potential. But, you know, again, the bill is out there. And what Senator Wicker has decided to do is to cherry pick out a couple of provisions that are important to him and his state, which is advancer funding and direct pay subsidy bonds.
Fantastic. And I guess
who in the House are driving these bond provisions in the transportation bill?
I think that's a great question, Michael. I have assumed for a very long time, that it is the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee who is driving this. But I also think that, you know, he's not alone, that there is the House Municipal Finance Caucus that is, you know, 20-some, 30-some strong right now. We've got Terry Sewell out of Alabama, one more out of Wisconsin. We have Tom Reed out of New York, who are all municipal bond advocates. And so together, those three who sit on the Ways and Means Committee may sort of carry the water for Neil at the beginning, but then if they own it, like Terry Sewell is 100% behind BQ. And so it is very important to make sure that they know that we love them for doing that. And we do continue to make sure that they know that.
Another, I guess, hope from some of our membership and just kind of floated around DC the past years or so, at least, is including these provisions into some type of appropriations or budget bill, I guess better said, but we're now getting word that they're just going to punt it again via a short-term continuing resolution at baseline numbers. So do you think that's off the table for 2020 as well?
Yes, unfortunately. I think, yeah, we've got a lot of kicking the can down the road, or as you said, punt it. I saw your beloved Florida State play the other day. So
it's the curse of GFOA, whether Virginia Tech or Georgia Tech. It's sad. So, it's sad. I'm sorry, my daughter's first game was that on Saturday. So
that's right. I just hope that they don't sack any potential of any municipal bond provisions being carried across to the goal line, because this is absolutely our number one priority. And if it is not now, Brett, I can absolutely guarantee you that the issuer community is going to run hard during lame duck and run hard as soon as the new Congress starts.
Well, that was a good turn there. I was curious to where you're going to take the Georgia Tech FSU game, but bravo. And we'll be right there with you pushing hard as well. So this time, Michael Decker, do you want to take it to the SEC temporary action, or should we go ahead and talk election and politics right here?
I'd like to get Emily's take on the temporary conditional exemption. It's, you probably know it's a really big issue for underwriters and duly registered underwriters and municipal advisors. And the dealer community in general has pushed back quite a bit against it. What's the view of the issuer community in general on that issue? And can you talk a little bit about how the deliberations went in the debt committee when you were discussing this issue? Was there broad consensus, or was there a difference of opinion?
I think that's a great question, Michael. Now, obviously, this all happened pre-pandemic. The conditional exempt order was, you know, something that I know that there were years and years of conversations that were being had at the broker-dealer level, at the MA level, and certainly along with the SEC. I was personally living in blissful ignorance about this conversation that was happening. However, that said, I don't think that all issuers were living in blissful ignorance, because at the local level, they were using placement agents and they were using MAs, and they knew where the bright line was and they respected that bright line. Now, when we were asked to comment, we officially commented. We are on record. We support the exemptive order. And, you know, I'd love to give you a little color on the discussion that happened. There are 26 varied types of issuers on the debt committee. To be honest, we have states represented on the debt committee who really didn't have an opinion on the matter because they didn't really privately place debt. But when we talk to, you know, large local government issuers versus smaller local government issuers, opinions were different and varied. When I talked to rural issuers as opposed to urban issuers and the capacity for them to have those professionals readily available to them was an issue. In aggregating the information and assessing the information and speaking on behalf of over 21,000 members, what we did is we offered very specific feedback on when and what circumstances why we would support the exemptive order. And when the provisional exemptive order was approved by the SEC, by the chairman, we put out a feeler to see if that changed the behavior or at least the decision matrix of GFOA members across the country. And in some cases it did, in some cases it didn't. We obviously have only been in this for a short amount of time, and you know, we shall see what the effects are.
That's helpful. Thank you.
So here at the BDA, I'm currently in my office. We've been talking with our members. What's everybody doing? Where's everybody working during the pandemic? How has that changed your daily business flow, your day-to-day operation? So at GFOA, are you guys still remote? Are majority of your members still remote? I mean, that's 21,000. That's an incredible number. So you can't, you know, give me exact specific answer here, but I'm just curious. Are we in the minority still remote? What are you guys doing?
Well, GFOA, we're here along with you. I'm sitting at my dining room table, and we are not going to return to our physical offices until January 1st, and then we'll assess after January 1st. But we did take a member survey, and we asked them about the change of working conditions, and it was very interesting to see the dynamic of local governments and how they've changed. There are still a fair amount of, it was like 10% of our membership was saying that they are going to go back to the office, but they'll do it on a limited schedule. Probably the vast majority was 50-50. I'm going to be working from home full time and I'm going back to the office full time. And so whether there's a fundamental shift in the way that we do business and, you know, how we are able to accomplish our tasks at hand, especially as municipal issuers, I think different localities are finding different solutions for their workforce.
That makes sense. I know
it's also important to put that in context, because there are a lot of revenue stresses on governments and there are a lot of layoffs that are happening. Absolutely. And so it's a very sensitive topic.
That makes sense. And I know the big difference with our members, the trading floor. There's a lot of logistical hurdles that they have to clear there. And I think folks are at this point in time trying to figure out how to get beyond 25% back, if that makes sense. But yeah, we at the BDA, we're taking it day by day, but I did read an article, I believe in the Washingtonian yesterday, that said 75% of offices expect to be remote through next spring, which is kind of a terrifying prospect at this point in time to stomach. So I remain hopeful we can get back to normalcy here shorter than next summer, but I guess that's yet to be seen. So one more final question, and I will add that Michael Decker put this in here. So if it gets out of hand, I'm going to turn it over to him pretty quickly.
I'll take the blame.
Yeah. With the election, the pending election, November 3rd, 2020, how in the world is that going to affect Washington? I mean, that's such a loaded question. If you want to play it safe, and how's that going to affect muni policy, feel free to, because I know that this could just be a freewheeling conversation. So I'll turn it over to you and then, of course, Decker to clean it up if need be.
I mean, I think to start it off, I would say, look, a change in party in the executive, but not a change in party in the Senate is totally different than a change in party in this presidency and a change in party in the Senate. So if we have a all Democrat Washington, that's going to look totally different than if the Senate retains Republican or if the executive retains Republican. So I think if we still have sort of the difference between Republicans and Democrats, the different houses, different control in different houses, we're going to see a little bit more of the same. I think that's going to be a bit of a challenge. But also, if we see consistency across the offices, we may see super swift action. Case in point, Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. When that happened, it was a fully Republican Washington, and it was a bullet train. And if we didn't get on it, we were going to get left behind. And so, of course, as we know, we grasped to get on that bullet train with advance refunding, but we didn't get on it. And so I think that we need to be careful. We need to be poised to sprint if it is an all Democratic Washington. And the last thing I would say is, what does that say for muni efforts if it is an all Democratic Washington? Well, munis are a bipartisan issue. We've had positive elements of our market come out of Republican mouths and positive elements of our market come out of Democratic mouths. And together, you know, we are trying to make sure that, you know, we maintain a one-in-one status. So no matter who's in charge, we would like to make sure that we are equal across the board. When it comes to Democrats, one thing that I can say is they do love direct pay subsidy bonds. They yes. love the stuff.
Yes.
So I think there's a very high likelihood of direct pay subsidy bonds coming back. The other thing I know about Democrats is their vitriolic hatred for everything Tax Cuts and Jobs Act.
Also true. Yes.
So they will try to dismantle as much as they can, whether it's SALT, whether it's advance refunding, whether it's corporate tax rate. They're certainly going to try take a stab at that. And it will be swift, I think. We have an exciting time ahead of us either way, but that's kind of what I'm thinking about in terms of how the municipal market might be affected come November 3rd.
Good insight. Michael, do you have any further questions? Or
I'm just going to ask one more thing. Can you tell us how you got into this line of work? Was this a childhood dream to be a muni bond lobbyist?
That's everybody's childhood dream, right? Trash man, fire truck driver, muni bond lobbyist. Those are my top three.
Well, so I started out my professional career at Wachovia Bank, and I single-handedly took it down. Just kidding. I really didn't. But I was there in 2007, and I was actually in governmental banking. So I had clients that were, you know, state of West Virginia and Culpeper, Virginia, and, you know, counties in North Carolina. So I knew I knew treasury products. I knew debt products. I believe it or not, I'm a pretty good salesperson. I know it's hard to believe. So once Wachovia kind of started to head down the path of joining with Wells Fargo, I became a new mom and I decided to stay at home with my children and kind of really think about where I was headed. Also, at the same time, I kind of decided to start to pursue my PhD, and I wrote my dissertation on GASB 68, or the pension reporting standards.
I bet you had to fight people off for that topic.
Yeah, but I was the first one to land a job. So,
right
there. Yeah, amen.
I presented this information at national conferences, and GFOA saw me, and it really became just sort of in my natural element. I can talk technicals with elected officials, and I love this stuff. But I think more importantly, I really love building coalitions. And it makes me very excited that together, GFOA can build a stronger voice with many of our mutual friends out there in the field. It really is delightful to work with you guys, and it brings me a lot of joy. So although I wasn't born to do this, I think I'm in the right place.
Absolutely. We're definitely stronger working together. No doubt about that.
You've done incredible work. So we're very thankful to work with you and to have you on the first podcast here. So with that, I think I'm going to wrap it up. Thank you, Emily. Thank you, Michael. We'll be back here at the same Bat Channel in 2 weeks, even though I think Michael said we might change that to bonds and beers next time. So I think that might be an avenue we need to look at. So with that, thank you, and everybody have a great afternoon.